Welcome back. We left off the story of the Roman Empire in 211 AD with the death of the soldier emperor Septimius Severus. And he had ruled just after the golden age of Rome and the time of the five good emperors. The next century of Roman history will be a particularly dramatic and traumatic stretch, during which the empire will suffer severe political, military, and economic crises, and it will end up looking certain to collapse. But then it will stage an unexpected, near miraculous recovery, and finally will undergo an even more surprising transformation into a Christian empire. This tumultuous era marks the beginning of the period known as the Later Roman Empire. In the 3rd century AD, Roman history entered a chaotic time when there was great political instability and really an extraordinarily high turnover rate of emperors. Consider that whereas there had been only about a half dozen emperors during the entire 2nd century, in the 3rd, that many rivals for the throne would often come and go in a single year. From 238 to 278 AD, there were at least 26 official emperors and dozens of usurpers. This was now truly the age of the soldier emperor, a time when the only real qualification you had to have was the loyalty of a lot of guys with swords. Typical of these men was a man named Maximinus Thrax, which literally translates as the big guy from Thrace. And true to his name, he began as a simple peasant from the region of Thrace, who allegedly was 7 feet tall. He enlisted in the Roman legions, he gained the favor of his fellow soldiers, and eventually had them proclaim him emperor. And so he may well have been the first peasant emperor. His success, though, was fairly short-lived, as soon his own troops turned against him and murdered him. Things were so bad during this time that historians have labeled this period the crisis of the 3rd century. And there are three main factors which contribute to this crisis. The first is that it was an era of near constant civil war. Most of the Roman legions had gotten grouped in just a couple provinces on the frontiers where danger threatened. And especially that was along the Rhine River, along the Danube River, and on the eastern frontier. And so the commanders of those three armies realized that they each controlled a significant part of the military. And so when a current emperor died, those generals would often bribe their legions to proclaim them as emperor. And since each of the three groups would declare their own general as emperor, you ended up with a vicious three-way civil war, as all converged on Rome with their armies to fight it out. Second, there were serious barbarian invasions in this period. So outside of Rome's borders, you have new, larger confederations of barbarians, which are forming up. And they want to invade and plunder the rich provinces of the empire. Normally, the legions would be standing guard against them. However, when one of these civil wars breaks out and all the Roman armies abandon the borders to go to Rome and fight each other, what do you think happens on the frontiers? The barbarians see opportunity. The third aspect of the crisis of the 3rd century is economic collapse, and it's very much a direct effect of the previous two. So cities were plundered both by outside invaders and sometimes by Roman armies fighting each other. Villages get burnt down, people are killed, crops are destroyed, merchants are afraid to travel any longer between towns, and with no one to control them, bandits and pirates proliferate. And so all of those things disrupt the economy and reduce the overall economic output. Even worse, as soon as one of these contenders for the throne manages to kill off his enemies and establish himself as emperor, often the first thing he does is to raise taxes in order to get the funds to rebuild the armies which had just been destroyed. But this is happening at the very time when farmers and merchants could least afford to pay more. So it all forms a vicious circle. absolutely desperate to gain more income, emperors debased the coinage. And this means that they added less valuable metals to coins, but they would keep the face value the same. People were not fooled by this, and so the inevitable result was that everybody raised their prices. And the problem really was that nobody simply trusted the coinage anymore, and so this sparked terrible bouts of inflation. And finally, all of those old technological limitations on communication that we looked at earlier, such as just the time it takes messages to travel from the emperor to the provinces, mean that now, when it's under stress, the empire is really too big to be run effectively by just one person. By the mid-3rd century, it looks like the end is at hand for the Roman Empire. There are constant civil wars, revolutions, self-proclaimed emperors are coming and going with bewildering rapidity, the economy is a complete mess, and barbarians are roaming unopposed through formerly peaceful Roman territories. Just then, a series of tough military emperors arrived on the scene, and they managed to stabilize the empire and even to give it at least another 100 years or so of life. While one of the main causes of the crisis of the 3rd century was that legionary commanders were proclaiming themselves emperor, in a way, this problem ultimately resulted in its own solution, since the men who inevitably rose to the top turned out to be the ones who were most capable of defeating the barbarians and reestablishing order. And these pragmatically minded soldiers also realized that the strategy which Rome had been using simply had to change. One of these guys was named Aurelian, and something of his character can be inferred from the nickname that his own troops gave him, which was Manus ad Ferrum, which you can loosely translate as hand on the sword. And in his 5-year reign, he first of all defeated several major barbarian groups and restored peace both in the east and the west. And then another famous action of his, which also shows his pragmatism, is that he had a wall built around the city of Rome. And Rome had not been enclosed by a wall since way back the time of the Roman Republic. And so sometimes the Aurelian Wall is viewed as an admission of Rome's weakness. But on the other hand, the construction of that wall was a very realistic response to the new sorts of threats that Rome was facing. The last in this little group of military reformers who turned things around is probably the best known of them, and he had the longest, most successful reign. His name is Diocletian. Diocletian defeated a number of barbarian groups to secure the borders, but he also instituted a number of other essential reforms. First of all, he reorganized the Roman army and made it larger. Under Diocletian, the total size of the armed forces rose to around 550 or 600,000 troops. And many of these new recruits were drawn directly from the most warlike of the barbarian tribes that were threatening Rome. So once again, in a way, Diocletian turned the problem into the solution. He also reoriented the armies from ineffectively being spread thinly all around the borders to what is called a defense-in-depth strategy. And there you have large centralized military reserves posted back behind the frontier. But from there, they're able to move to intercept and eliminate barbarian invasions. Diocletian also finally separated the civilian and military structures. So no longer were legion commanders these short-term political appointees, but now they were career military men, professionals. Likewise, governors were now exclusively civil administrators, rather than trying to be both military and civilian leaders. And to try to increase the overall efficiency of the administration, he split up the provinces into smaller units. So before Diocletian, there had been about 50 provinces, but now there were over 100. And in practical terms, what this meant was that each governor now had less to do, and so he could concentrate all of his efforts on a smaller, more manageable area. With each governor focusing on local issues, there was a need for an administrator who could still look at the big picture in a whole region. And to fill this gap, Diocletian clumped together provinces into a number of larger units called dioceses. And each diocese was under the control of an overall administrator whose title was vicar. And probably you recognize both of those are titles that the Catholic Church would later adapt to its hierarchy. Although these government posts wouldn't last for long, the terms were later copied for various church officials. Similarly, the legions were consolidated into several large multi-legion armies, and each one of those was placed under the command of an overall general whose title was dux, a term from which we later get the English cognate duke. Finally, Diocletian realized that the empire really was too big for any one man to effectively govern. So, he in essence made official what had already happened. He split the empire into four parts, and he appointed a ruler for each part. So now, there were four co-emperors who would rule together, but each was responsible for one section of the empire. And the system of four emperors is called the Tetrarchy. And there's a very famous porphyry statue which is now embedded in a corner of St. Mark's Cathedral in Venice, which shows Diocletian and his three fellow tetrarchs firmly clasping each other's shoulder in a symbolic display of unity and determination. Once again, we see Diocletian cleverly turning the problem into the solution, since for years the empire had been already fragmenting into these different pieces. And so, in a way, he was just making official what had been going on. And while not all aspects of this reorganization would last for long, collectively, these reforms and attempts at reforms created more attention to detail at the local level, as well as more organization and strategy at the broad level. Eliminating civil wars and barbarian invasions obviously went a long way towards restoring the economy, but there was still the problems of rampant inflation and general distrust of the currency. And so, in order to try and rebuild people's faith in money, a new solid gold coin was issued. And this is a coin whose purity and weight of metal were guaranteed. And in a gesture of optimistic propaganda, the official term for this new denomination of coin was the solidus, a name that translates as a solid bit, in other words, something you can trust. Then, in 301 AD, in an effort to curb inflation, Diocletian issued a document known as the Price Edict. And this was a long, long list of goods and services which gave a maximum price that could be charged for each one. And this was not really that successful, since there are obvious difficulties when trying to enforce something like this so broadly. But at least it was an attempt. And it probably did have some effect in areas where there were Romans to enforce it. So in theory, if you charged more than the price which was listed, you could be punished, sometimes with exile or even death. Diocletian's Price Edict survives, and it's a very fascinating document, particularly to economic historians, both for the light it sheds on the relative value of goods and services, and just for the absolute range of items which get listed in this thing. For example, it distinguishes between multiple gradations of fineness of various textiles, such as linen and wool. It identifies several different grades of animal hides, from the highest quality, which it says is suitable for making the soles of shoes, to a low-grade material which you can only use to patch things up. It lists fees that can be charged to hire the services of various professionals, everything ranging from blacksmiths to barbers. Actually, can you guess what type of service commanded the very highest fee? The answer might be a familiar one. It was for legal advice and services, so some things really never change. Finally, another reform of Diocletian was to try to give greater stability to the office of emperor and to create more respect and authority for him by explicitly linking, for the very first time, the emperors and the gods. Now, in the past, many emperors had been deified after their death, or they had been unofficially worshipped as gods. But now the emperors began to liken themselves to gods while still alive. For example, in their portraits on coins, the emperors were now shown with rays of light coming out of their heads, like the sun god. And later, when Christians began to depict God in art, they copied that convention. And so we know that today by the term halo. Diocletian and the other emperors also surrounded themselves with more formal court ceremony. So Diocletian became the first emperor, or maybe I should say the first sane emperor, to wear a golden cloak and jeweled shoes, and who required people to address him as Lord or God. One unintended consequence of all this was that since the emperors were associating themselves with certain gods, then any religious challenge to those gods took on the nature of a political challenge. And so this also meant that for the first time, political unity at least implied nominal religious unity. And so in connection with this, Diocletian began to discourage and even sometimes to persecute deviant religious cults. And among these was a small group known as Christians. Well, we've come nearly 300 years past the birth of Christ, but I haven't mentioned Christianity yet. And mostly that's because up until this point, it had really not had much influence beyond a minuscule circle of believers. To a Roman, or really almost to anyone living around most of the Mediterranean Sea at this time, Christianity would have just appeared as one of hundreds of tiny, obscure religions and cults that coexisted within the Roman Empire. But within the next 100 years, Christianity will become the official religion of the Roman state. And to understand both its rise and the conflicts which develop between Christian and non-Christians, let's back up a little bit and consider some of the fundamental differences between Christianity and most other religions of the time. Two key components of standard Roman religious beliefs were, of course, its polytheism and its public nature. Like nearly every other Mediterranean culture, except for the Jews, the Romans believed that there were an infinite number of legitimate gods. And in general, they were really quite open to accepting new gods and allowing what today we might term religious tolerance. Now, there were definitely certain gods who were worshipped and various rites that were performed on behalf of the state and other collective public entities. But in addition to that, people could typically choose one or even multiple gods that they personally worshipped. And often these were part of more individually focused cults, such as those of Isis or Mithras. Christianity, in contrast, was rigidly and strictly monotheistic. They asserted an exclusive belief in one and only one God, their own. Christianity was also much more privately focused as a religion. So Christians tend to worship indoors, and they concentrated far more on the relationship between individuals and God. And in contrast, Roman religious rituals were almost always held outdoors in highly public settings. And so this apparently furtive nature of Christian worship, at least from a Roman perspective, was one of the things that, to Roman eyes, made Christians seem a little bit suspicious. Another big difference is that Christianity had a sacred written text, the Bible, which helped to define what its worshipers believed. After the crucifixion of Jesus, around 27 AD, Christianity initially spread very, very slowly. And a key figure in its establishment was, of course, Paul, who, by traveling and preaching all around the Mediterranean, and also by addressing his message both to Jews and non-Jews, greatly widened its audience. If you view the spread of Christianity from a historical rather than a religious perspective, there are a number of aspects of Christianity that obviously had considerable appeal, including that it emphasized morality and good behavior, that it offered a link between that behavior and the reward of immortality after death. And also, Christianity didn't recognize the existing Roman legal and social hierarchies. But instead, it offered a system in which all humans had value and dignity and were equal in the eyes of God. The Romans, generally speaking, were normally quite tolerant of other religions, but they always had trouble with Judaism and Christianity because of their monotheism. The Romans simply couldn't understand Christian stubborn insistence on the exclusivity of their one God. Romans were puzzled by Christianity's apparent secrecy, and they were troubled by the way in which it could make slaves, women, and non-citizens seemingly equal to citizens. But nevertheless, the primary conflict came from a rather odd source. Some emperors had begun to be deified after their deaths, and to become objects of cult activity even while alive. So, on an emperor's birthday, it was expected that all citizens or people in the empire would say a prayer for the health of the emperor, and they would direct this towards the aspect of him that might become divine. Usually, they would also make a little offering of food or wine. The authorities expected everybody to participate in this, and the only reason that they could see why you wouldn't do so was if you were treasonous, or maybe you were some sort of revolutionary trying to overthrow the state. Now, to a Christian, as to a Jew, taking part in this sort of ritual was a clear violation of the first commandment, which says, do not worship other gods. And so, naturally, they refused to do it. So, something that to many Romans was predominantly a political act, something analogous today to maybe reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, was to the Christians a matter of core religious belief. And really, all of this, to some degree, amounted almost in a kind of tragic failure of communication and understanding. But the actual result could be persecution and violent death. Until Diocletian, most Roman officials and emperors plainly had fairly little inclination or desire to actively hunt down or punish Christians. There's a couple exceptions. But under Diocletian, during the stresses of dealing with all the various crises facing the state, there was a perception that unity became especially vital. And in this sort of emergency situation, they couldn't afford any margin for forms of dissent. And so in 299 AD, for the first time, Christians were officially, actively persecuted on an empire-wide scale. Having saved the empire, in a sense, Diocletian then voluntarily retired, and he's really the only Roman emperor ever to do this. And he spent the rest of his life living in a huge palace that he had built for himself in what today is the town of Split in Croatia. And by the way, if you go to Split today, the remains of that palace have been absorbed right into the buildings of the city. So you can see little bits of the palace scattered around. But if you go down underground, you can still wander around the unchanged basement of Diocletian's palace. Events would take an abrupt and unexpected turn early in the next century. Under Diocletian and his colleagues, immediate disaster had been staved off. But there was still a lot of political instability. Civil wars among all these rivals for the throne continued. And in the early 4th century, one contender for the throne was a man named Constantine. He started out as somewhat of a long shot, but he got lucky, he won a couple battles, and he began to grow powerful. And Constantine had a clever way to inspire his troops before key battles. He would claim that he had had a vision from a god who promised them victory. So, for example, before one battle, he stopped in at a temple to the sun god Apollo, and then he made the claim that Apollo had appeared to him in a vision and promised him victory. So after this, Constantine would identify himself with Apollo, for example, by issuing a coin that showed a portrait of him and Apollo together. In 312 AD, Constantine marched with his army to try to capture Rome. And the battle to determine who would emerge as the emperor of the western half of the Roman Empire took place at a site just outside of Rome called the Milvian Bridge. Now, Constantine was at a disadvantage. His troops were tired, they were outnumbered, their morale was low. But right before the battle, he claimed to have had another vision. And along with this vision, there were some accompanying dreams, and in these, the Christian God appeared to him and promised victory. So following up on this vision, his men painted a divine Christian symbol, which consisted of chi and rho. That's the first two letters of the name Christ when written in Greek on their shields. His men were inspired, and they won the battle. And Constantine then issued a decree that Christianity was now to be tolerated. At the time, probably less than 10% of the empire's inhabitants were Christian. So Constantine converted when 90% of Romans were not Christian yet. And to be honest, his understanding of Christianity's doctrines seems to have been a bit shaky. For example, he continued after his conversion to Christianity to subsidize pagan temples and to supply sacrifices to them from the imperial treasury. He continued after his conversion to Christianity to worship the sun god, and he still kept minting coins bearing Apollo's image. And he also seems to have had a somewhat inflated view of his role in the church. He seemed to have viewed himself as the head of the Christian church. So he would summon meetings of bishops and preside over them as if he were the pope. And he built a church which contained statues of the 12 apostles. And in the center, he left a niche for himself, apparently either as the 13th apostle or even as an equal to Christ. But nevertheless, from this point on, all but one emperor would follow his example and would be Christian. One secular appeal that Christianity may have had for Roman emperors was that they could extend the idea of there being only one true God to the concept that there was only one legitimate emperor themselves. And so you can see how this would be a very useful ideology during a time when dealing with lots of different rivals for the throne, and when issues of legitimacy was one of the greatest problems facing Roman emperors. From this moment on, the Roman Empire effectively splits into two halves, and there will be separate Eastern and Western Roman emperors and empires. And in acknowledgement of this reality, Constantine founded a new city to serve as the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. Not very modestly, he named the city Constantinople after himself. and he equipped it with most of the features that were found at Rome, including, of course, a palace, a chariot racing arena, a senate, even a grain dole. Just like Augustus, Constantine then claimed that he had saved or restored the Roman Republic. Here we see that old propaganda of Roman politics still in use, 300 years after it had obviously stopped being a republic. In the next lecture, we'll see if Constantine was as successful in the long run as Augustus in revitalizing the Roman state. And despite all the chaos of the 3rd century, it was a time when crucial new elements were emerging and taking shape. And nowhere was that more true than in the area of religion. Thank you.